Welcome to Pod Summarizer, the way to summarize your favorite podcasts. Today, we have a summary of Danny Jones. In this episode, the host delves into the intriguing world of Joseph Farrell, a well-known figure in the study of Nazi UFO connections. The discussion explores Farrell's evolution from focusing on secret technology to considering extraterrestrial interpretations of the UFO phenomenon, highlighting his extensive research and insights. Remember to follow us on X and Instagram and on our website podsummarizer.xyz. And now, let's begin.
We just had this lady on the other day who was friends with this dude that I just learned about named Joe. I'm sure you've heard of him. Joseph Farrell.
Oh, yeah, I know Joe very well.
You know him personally?
Yeah, we're friends.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
I know Joseph. God, I just learned about this guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was just blown
I've known
away
Joe for years.
By some of this stuff.
Yeah.
What do you make of that research? I mean, this is the title of that book. What was it? Swastikas and Flying Saucers.
Yeah, well, Joseph has, I don't know where he is now, because he wrote his first, like, basically, he became known as the Nazi UFO guy.
Okay.
Like, that was really, his original training was in, what's it called, patristics. So, studying Eastern Orthodox religiosity, like Eastern Orthodox Christianity.
He's like a bishop in the Catholic Church of Russia or something.
Yeah, I think Orthodox.
Okay.
Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox,
yeah,
some version
sense.
Of that. And but he's a really highly intelligent man, of course, mm-hmm. and he got into studying the Nazi UFO connection and looking at the Foo Fighters and particularly in Europe as potentially Nazi Third Reich technology, and so he went into that in several books. However, you know, the thing with Joseph, I mean, you would have to ask him directly about this, what he thinks today, but I know that he became very, very open to an extraterrestrial interpretation of the UFO phenomenon over time. Because like in the early years, I think it was easy to interpret all of his work as saying all of this phenomenon is secret tech, mm-hmm. earthbound secret tech, and I don't think that he's in that place, at least the last few times that we've talked, I didn't really think that he was. So I don't know. You know, we're always evolving. We're always like
we are
constantly thinking through, like, what do I think this year as opposed to last year? Mm-hmm. And it's important because, speaking for myself, I've gone to a lot of different places as to like what I think is actually happening when we talk about UFOs or now UAP.
I always love talking. Are we rolling, Steve?
Yeah, I'm wondering.
Steve, are we good?
We are rolling.
Oh, beautiful. So good. I always love the opportunity arises to talk to somebody like yourself. Because I've only talked to maybe roughly three, maybe four people on this show that have been studying this topic for over 25, 30 years, like yourself.
Yeah.
Most people have been in this stuff just, you know, for a few years recently, since like the emergence of YouTube. But I think it was like the first one was James Fox, then Jason Giorgiani, Stephen Greer, these types of folks. And you, I've noticed that you've been in a lot of some of like the biggest documentaries on this topic. So it's always just so interesting to hear people's takes on this stuff when they've been studying it for so long. Mm-hmm. But for people that don't know who you are, can you just give like a brief summary of how you got into this stuff in the first place and what you've been doing ever since?
Gladly.
Steve, my audio sounds really odd. Maybe it's just my headphones. Okay. All right. Yeah.
Brief background. So, I got involved in this subject a little over 30 years ago. So it was in the like 1993, 94. Mm-hmm. At that time, I was trying to pursue a completely different life. I was working on a PhD in history, Cold War studies at the University of Rochester in upstate New York. And I was very much into that. Previous to that, I'd studied a lot of European history, a lot of diplomatic history. So that was really my background. And I was in a bookstore in upstate New York, in Syracuse, actually. And I think it was 1994, and I saw on a display stand a copy of a book by Timothy Good called Above Top Secret, which is kind of a classic in the UFO field. And it was the subtitle of that book that really caught my attention, The Worldwide UFO Cover-Up. And I was like, oh, wow. It's like it's 1994, and I didn't know anything about UFOs, like essentially literally nothing. And I'd only heard, I'd seen, you know, some old documentaries. I'd watched Leonard Nimoy on In Search Of and seen some of those things, but I really didn't know anything. And I'd only heard claims of cover up and this and that. So I remember flipping through Tim's book and I thought, wow, he's got some like interesting documents. He had names of people that I was studying in my own research. And I thought, oh, wow, UFOs, departments that I was looking into and UFO connections there. And I thought, you know, this is like a completely like unofficial version of history here. Is this true or is this nonsense, right? And that was really my question. So I bought the book and I liked the book. It's a great book. And at the same time, I got onto what was then the baby version of the internet, all of the Usenet groups, people yelling and screaming at each other. But there were some good threads there, and there were a couple of people that I really learned from. And I just went down this rabbit hole, and I thought, I'm going to spend 2 or 3 months of my life, and I want to find out, is there something to this, or is there not something? Because here I was studying basically the presidency of Harry Truman. I'm looking at the early Cold War, 1950, and I'm thinking, there were claims that there was a very big UFO cover-up going on by then, and these were not trivial claims. And I just thought, what I don't like is having a big question mark hanging over my head on an area where I was trying to become an expert, and I just wanted to know. I just wanted to know. And so I thought I'd spend a couple of months to look into it, and I got hooked. I got totally hooked. Like, I discovered there were some very powerful declassified U.S. government documents that were obtained through Freedom of Information, which itself didn't really get going until the late 1970s, when Jimmy Carter kind of strengthened FOIA at that time. And so at that time, a lot of very interesting U.S. government military documents were released that they wouldn't prove that UFOs are aliens, but they did prove, absolutely proved, that these flying saucers that the government was telling the world, nothing to this, it's all hoaxes, misidentification. Mm-hmm. They proved that, no, actually, military personnel were seeing objects described as flying saucer shape, invading sensitive airspace that they were not supposed to be doing, engaging in maneuvers that were supposed to be impossible, being chased by our aircraft, and essentially playing cat and mouse games over and over again.
Right.
For years and years. And, you know, you read, and then you read statements by the director of scientific intelligence of the CIA in 1952, a man named H. Marshall Chanwell, who's telling his boss, Walter Beadle Smith, director of the CIA, that this phenomena is being seen at such altitudes and over sensitive military installations in such a manner that they are not attributable to natural phenomena or known types of aerial vehicles. That's a direct quote. And you read that and you're like, how else can he put it other than saying, boss, I think we're being invaded. So I read enough of these documents early on to think there's absolutely something that is at least worth investigating. And then that opens up like 1,000 other questions, like where are the other academicians? Where's the university crowd looking into this? You would think if you want to debunk this, fine, debunk it. Let's look at the actual evidence here and deal with it. But they never deal with it. They would never deal with the fact that, like, why was the first director of the CIA, a man named Roscoe Hellencotter, a member of a UFO organization called NICAP in the 1950s, until he clearly under pressure resigned in 1962, just before NICAP was trying to get congressional hearings back then.
So the CIA was created the same year Roswell happened, right? Or was it a year later?
No, 1947.
1947, right.
Although you could see the predecessor organization, the OSS, during World War II.
Having delved into the intriguing connections between government secrecy and UFO phenomena, the conversation shifts to the complexities of misinformation in this realm, as new insights emerge about the ongoing struggle for truth.
Make your hair great again with Hims.
It's like, are we dealing with a covert op by the government to have a controlled and false release of UFO information to serve their needs? Or what, I'm not sure if they even want it out fully themselves, but to some extent, but there's still the secrecy group, if we can call them that, that is absolutely not resolved to that at all, not reconciled to that, and they will fight every step of the way.
Yeah, I think when I had Jesse Michaels in here, he told me that as far as like all of the information that exists about this stuff on the internet, he was saying only like 20% of it needs to be fake. He's like 80% of it can be real, and still no one will ever know what to believe.
Yeah,
people will just fight about it.
It's probably right. I think it's even less than 20% that needs to be fake.
Wow, really?
I don't. I mean, I think so. Because there's always, look, you've got trolls out there. You've got hardcore skeptical people out there, of course.
Oh, it's crazy. People and they will treat this like a religion.
Yeah, man. They will hammer on any little thing that just seems a little off, and they'll just go after it. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And you could have, I mean, we just had this congressional briefing just the other day, as we're recording this,
mm-hmm.
in the very beginning of May. You had—
Oh, I missed that.
Well, it was very interesting. So you had Dr. Eric Davis, who was hardly ever—
Oh, I did see this, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Eric Davis, anytime he talks, you really want to listen to that man.
Mm.
But—
Why is that?
He's worked very closely for many years with Hal Puthoff. He's worked with Robert Bigelow's National Institute for Discovery Science back in the 90s and early 2000s. He is a man who interviewed Admiral Thomas R. Wilson in 2002, which was a whole big thing. That came out in 2019. That was a big mess, but it was all true. Davis meets with Wilson after Wilson had retired from the Defense Intelligence Agency. He had run the DIA. And this is connected. You interviewed Stephen Greer. So yeah. Stephen Greer was very much a part of this. So back in 1997, all right, Greer and Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut, and a few other individuals were going through Washington, D.C. And Greer, you know, look, he can be very polarizing, but he was right on with this. And I will always say this. In 1997, Greer was like, there are black programs that are rogue, that deal with ET tech, reverse engineering. They are beyond the formal control of the U.S. government. And so they're trying to get audiences with different people to talk about this. And they get to meet with Admiral Thomas R. Wilson, who was head of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff at that time. This is April 1997. And they gives a presentation. And Wilson, and I know this is absolutely true, said, I'm going to look into this.
The head of the Joint Chiefs?
Yeah. Well, he's head of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs.
Okay.
So, or he was deputy head of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs. He then became head of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs, which was head of the DIA. So he was important. And he goes on a two-month wild goose chase, actually, within the Pentagon's bureaucratic structure. We can go into more detail if you want, but the short version is he finds a number, not just one, several special access programs, that is ultra, ultra secret programs dealing with ET tech. He contacts the managers of one of them, and he's actually able to get a private in-person meeting with them. They are the program manager, the security manager, and the corporate attorney, right? For this, it was a private contractor. We don't know that it was Lockheed, but that's what the betting money is. So he goes to meet with them, and he says, it is your— We're getting back to Eric Davis, I promise you.
Okay. So
Wilson says, it is your oversight that I am not overseeing this program. You need to bring me in. You do not have proper oversight of this. And they're like, no, we're fine. We don't need you. Well, that's a real problem. He finds out from them.
I remember Greer telling me this.
Yes, right. And he finds out, like, this is, they have an intact saucer, according to what they said to him. They've made painfully slow progress in understanding it. They had what's called the Bigot List, B-I-G-O-T, and it's an acronym deriving from World War II. Anyway, that's the list of people who are allowed to be honest, and it's like 500 people. And Wilson's is reading the list. He's recognizing very few names from the DOD. They're almost all in private industry. And he says, no, I need to be— This is part of my purview. And they're like, no, it isn't. He says, well, I'll complain. They're like, be my guest. We're not afraid. We're not afraid of you. And he did go back to D.C. He did complain, and he was threatened with his career. He was threatened he'd lose a star or two along the way and take an early retirement. And he got furious, but he ended up playing ball. So anyway, because he was there with Edgar Mitchell, and there was another Navy commander named Willard Miller, was part of this. And Miller, these are Navy guys, so Miller, Mitchell, and Wilson, they're all Navy. Apparently, Wilson and Miller chatted about this after, and Miller, I guess, learned that Wilson had failed in getting access to this program. And so somehow this got back to Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut. And Mitchell was in with the National Institute for Discovery Science. That's Robert Bigelow. That's all these other guys, right? Davis,
okay.
Potthoff,
okay.
And many others. And so they all knew. They all knew that there was this failed attempt by the head of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs to get access to this program, and he was denied access. So it's kind of a big thing. Like, you know, you learn this fact and you're like, how do we get to Wilson? We want to talk to him. So Wilson retires in 02, and clearly Eric Davis, who was part of the NIDS group, he's the one. He goes out and he interviews Wilson. He got the scoop. And he writes up roughly 15 pages of typewritten notes of his conversation with Wilson. I am mentioning this because someone in that group, and I cannot say who it was, unfortunately.
Oh, you know, but you cannot say it publicly.
I read portions of that document back in 2000 and
okay, so it's still secret.
Six. Yeah, 2006 and seven. Six. Seven. 2007. Mm-hmm. And then, and I read the portion where Wilson is telling Davis this technology was not made by Earth, not made by man, not by human hands. In the Davis notes, it's italicized. And I remembered reading it. It struck me like it's very profound. You know, this is not made by human hands.
Having uncovered the profound implications of Wilson's revelations, the conversation shifts to the current landscape of UFO discourse, delving into the emotional roller coaster and the complexities surrounding these phenomena.
There has never been anything like the time that we're in now. This is unprecedented. And where it will lead is a really good question.
Yeah. Yeah. So over the last couple months, I mean, like my emotions on this whole topic vary. It's like I ride this roller coaster of emotions on the UFO topic from being A, I get burnt out on it super easily.
Yeah.
I get like this UFO fatigue. And then I also go back and forth between like, is it really aliens? Is it time travelers? Is it DARPA? And like, you know, my recent thing has been like, this has to be all just military bullshit mixed with internet psychological psyops, or just like you just alluded, feeding us this fire hose of misinformation just to get everyone confused. Mm-hmm. So nobody can know, like, it doesn't matter what the truth is because there's just, everything's out there and everyone's fighting about it. There's too much noise and no signal.
Yeah, I'm very sympathetic to that. And as far as the burnout goes, I've done this for 30 years.
Right.
And my wife could tell you, like, when it's after dinner time, I almost, like, I have to think about other things. I can't do UFOs anymore.
Yeah.
Like, in the old days, I would go to like 2-3 in the morning, just like,
mm-hmm.
And nowadays, like, I do it in the morning and the afternoons, and then I have to end it.
Yeah.
I have to have other things going on in my life. So I can sympathize with that. But as far as like what's going on, the reason that I very much believe that the significant portion of this phenomenon is from non-human intelligence. And the reason I believe that is I look at the earliest history of this, particularly the post-World War II, but even there are some very, I would say good, not perfect, but good accounts from prior to World War II that are worth looking at as well. And so when you look at some of these early cases, and then particularly when you read the declassified documents that I mentioned earlier that are available, it's hard for me to square that with a secret U.S. black budget project. It just doesn't, because all the intelligence officers that we know of at the time in the 40s we're looking into this, and there's nothing that I have seen that really make, even you mentioned Joseph Farrell's work.
Yeah.
Were we on camera when we talked about Joe? I can't.
Were we, Steve? I don't remember. We were talking about Joseph Farrell before this thing started.
And I'm a friend of Joe's, and I respect and admire his work a lot, but mm-hmm. I don't even think that he has made a clear-cut case that it's definitely all like, you know, Third Reich tech and all of that. I mean— mm-hmm.
There's definitely the Horton brothers, which was Earth.
Yeah. There's the Horton brothers. Yeah. And I think now, we're seeing more and more support for the idea of a 1933 Italian recovery.
Right.
Italian.
Mm-hmm. This is, I think, Grush talked about this, right?
Grush talked about it. Malmgren in his interview with Jesse Michaels. And Eric Davis in his congressional briefing talked about it. So we're seeing all these different perspectives coming in on this. The real man who researched this is an Italian researcher named Roberto Pinotti, who looked at a lot of the original documents that do exist in Italian from 1933. And
interesting.
So I think, yes, like this goes back farther in time than a lot of the American researchers, like because we're so American-centered. It's like Roswell, yeah. It all starts there.
Yeah.
No, I think there's, even in the U.S., there were prior cases to Roswell, but certainly this 1933 case.
So you think the fact that these cases or crash recoveries, retrievals, whatever you want to call them, they go back so far earlier than the 1940s, you think that points to it being of non-human origin just because of how advanced it was and how early it was?
Yeah, I think so. That's what I believe in.
And where do you think they would have come from? I know we're being super speculative here. I'm just saying like
I would say another planet.
Another planet, right?
Or there's a couple of different ways to look at this. So, you know, Hal Puthoff wrote a very interesting paper a number of years ago on ultra-terrestrials, this concept. And it's a very interesting paper. I highly recommend people read it. And I think his take, and he just mentioned this the other day in his interview, but maybe there's been a group that's been here a long time that originally comes from elsewhere. Mm. They've set up shop in some manner, which I think is a totally possible. I would imagine that the extraterrestrial hypothesis actually still makes more sense to me than anything else. I mean, we can get attracted to interdimensional theories, but does anyone actually even understand what another dimension would be? Like, how does that work? Mm-hmm. How do they materialize? Mm-hmm. Maybe it's possible, but I don't really understand how that's possible. I can understand how it could be possible, even despite the vast distances, to go interstellar if you can manipulate space-time in some way, bending space-time. We have math for that. A guy named Miguel Alcubierre in the 90s apparently came up with some version of warp drive mathematically. The problem is finding the amount of energy sufficient to do it. But
same thing with I think that's the same thing with time travel, right?
I think so. Yeah, you know. So
I love Michael Masters' time travel theory.
I don't know if I'm on top of that one. So okay. Maybe you can educate me. Yeah. But I guess I'll just say I think the fact that they come from another place still makes the most sense to me. Mm-hmm. The fact that we would be of interest makes a lot of sense to me. The fact that Earth would be a very interesting place also makes a lot of sense to me. I think all of that makes perfect sense. That mm-hmm. if you have the ability, if you've achieved a technological capability to detect advanced life elsewhere, which I don't see that as impossible at all. I mean, we're already looking at exoplanetary systems and looking for life signatures. And we just started with this business. So if you've been doing this for 1,000 years or more, maybe you can detect consciousness. We talked about remote viewing.
Yeah.
Could they actually have the ability to detect advanced consciousness? I don't know. Maybe they can. Or maybe there are other technologies that we just haven't envisioned. Mm-hmm. So they could find us. And then could they get to us? Yeah, probably. I don't see why not. At least in theory, I think mm-hmm. it could be entirely possible. And we would be interesting because, A, there could be a lot of life in this universe, but how common, really, would planets like ours be? We're in the Goldilocks zone, but it takes a lot more than that.
Right.
We have...
The moon is...
We have the moon.
Incredible.
Which is... It's the word?
It's the perfect terraforming device. It's one, I think it's 1/20th the size of the sun and 1/20th the distance from the sun. I think I'm getting that math right.
Oh, it's a lot less than 1/20th the size.
Maybe I'm getting that math wrong, Steve. Maybe you can correct me with the fractions there. Anyways, the fractions are exact. The exact size comparison to the sun and the exact distance from the sun is equal. So it creates that perfect eclipse. Yeah. And so that makes...
Yeah, that's an amazing thing. If that's a significant part.
Having explored the intricate relationship between technology and survival, the narrative shifts to a more alarming reality. As we delve into the implications of humanity's advancements in weaponry and the watchful eyes observing our trajectory.
So now we have hundreds of them circling the oceans loaded with nuclear warheads.
Exactly. So that's a major, imagine you're them. Let's say you are them. You're here. You're watching these humans, these observant, intelligent, multi-fingered humans who can manipulate their environment, who are now organized into these collective, aggressive communities we call nations, peering over the fence at each other with deadly weapons that could end the entire planet's existence. And you're watching this, and you're realizing, okay, so they're probably this far away from developing strong AI, from quantum computing, and from leaping into our world. Like, when's that going to happen?
Right?
Because, like, you can see the whole trajectory. You know that, like, a few generations ago, they were all living in wooden huts, and now, wow, like, here we are.
About to reach the singularity.
Yes, exactly. So I have little doubt that any observing intelligence, like, they can see this whole thing play out. And so they're watching. But I have no doubt that we have our own little unique variations on the theme of developing intelligence. Maybe we're more aggressive. Maybe we're not as I don't know. But we're certainly very aggressive with each other. We're highly territorial. So they're watching all of this, and they're seeing, you know, 1950s, we start developing nuclear submarines that can stay underwater basically forever. Mm-hmm. And we develop these underground sonar systems that are mapping all activity, or increasingly more and more underwater activity, including anomalous activity, right? Mm-hmm. And not just Soviet or Russian subs, but everything.
Yeah.
And so they have to adapt. And I think when I was looking at the statistics of this, this whole thing happened because I finished writing all the cases, and I'm talking with my wife, and she's like, you know, it'd be a great idea if for each case you had like a bunch of categories so that someone could just like look at the categories, like what color was the craft? What shape was the craft?
Yes.
What was it doing with the water? Was it under the water? Did it emerge from the water? How close are the witnesses? And I'm like, damn it, that's a really good idea. I didn't want to do it because it was a lot of extra work. I had to go back over every case and siphon out that information, but it was a great idea, and I did do it, and I'm very glad I did it, because then that allowed me to put all of that into a spreadsheet and look at like almost 700 cases and like 20. It's a big spreadsheet.
So it's like a database you've built.
Yeah, and anyone can download it. It's a free download. I have it linked on my website. But basically, I'm an amateur with statistical analysis. I can't pretend that I'm some genius at it, but you can still see things. So like one thing I noticed is one category was I broke it down into day or night. Simple. Did this happen when the sun was out or when it was dark? Like very simple little metric there. And one thing I noticed was that up until around 1967, 68, it was almost exactly 50-50 day versus night. And then suddenly starting in the late 60s.
USOs.
Yeah, USOs. Exactly. Starting in the late 60s, it goes to 75% at night, and it remained that to this day, 75%. Now, I mean, does that mean I just have too small a data sample and I need to get more cases? Yeah, maybe. Could it be that I was just somehow not selecting a broad spectrum of cases? I mean, all of that's possible. I don't think so. I try to pick what I thought were the best and most meaty cases, and something seems to have happened in the late 60s.
How do you go about mining all this information? Do you just look for and just scrub the internet for cases involving USOs, or do you interview specific people, ask them?
A little bit of both.
Okay.
Mostly pulling out the information from, there are a couple of websites where there's a lot of information. So one is the National UFO Reporting Center that's run by a very wonderful man named Peter Davenport, who's run it for years. And they've got 100,000 or more cases there that he's collected going back many, many years. So that's important. MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, has a database, which they graciously allowed me to use their database, which is nice because I'm not a MUFON investigator, but they knew what kind of work I was doing. Mm-hmm. And they said, yes, you can. And then I mentioned Carl Feint earlier. He had a website where he collected a bunch of these cases. So I looked at all of those. And then there's books and like out of print magazines from the 1970s that I'd look for and just get them and find these cases.
Where are people seeing these USOs?
Everywhere.
For the most part, is there one spot in the world where they seem to be mostly condensed to or confined to? And second question is, what kind of people are reporting these?
Yeah, there are hot spots. Part of the problem with USOs is we live on the land. We're landlubbers. And so Usually you're not out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Mm-hmm. So that's a problem right there. Mm-hmm. Navies are, the U.S. Navy is, but they don't like to talk. You'll get Navy stories from some Navy guy like 20, 30 or more years after they retire, when sometimes anonymously they will report something to some website somewhere.
Yeah.
Like that happens. And I've tried to collect all of those. They're very interesting. But basically we are, you know, so when people see these, they're usually on the coast. Or maybe they're on a lake or a river, but if it's an ocean base, which is most of them, it's along the coast. That's where people—
What about like oil rigs?
Yeah, a couple of them. There's a good one from the Gulf of Mexico. Am I a Gulf of America? Gulf of Mexico?
Gulf of America, brother. That's where we are, right there. Gulf's right there.
Exactly. So one of my, there's quite a few from the Gulf here, quite a few. And one of my favorite ones, this is from the National UFO Reporting Center. It's from 2017. It's not that long ago. A guy operating on a rig rode into New Fork, the website, and he described this. He said, I was with a bunch of other guys on our rig, and there was another rig, he said, a couple of miles over this way. And in between this humongous, gargantuan, like football field plus size object comes out of the water, dripping water, flying saucer disc shape.
Football field?
That's what he wrote. We're watching it drip water. We're kind of blown away, and it just zips off. It's gone. Now, how do you investigate that? It's almost impossible. So Peter Davenport wrote as an addendum to this case. He said, I spoke with the witness on the phone. Peter will do that sometimes. He said, I found him to be highly credible, highly this and that. And like, apparently this was a very well-spoken, believable individual. Peter found him credible. And that's really all that we have on this. But it's a pretty interesting story. And I read the account. Mm. And that's one of the cases that goes into the third volume of my study.
Did that corroborate any other accounts? Were there any other similar accounts with football fields? Really?
Yeah. Also, not just USOs, but you get UFO cases of gargantuan size objects that have been reported over the years. You wonder, like, what are they doing? It's like a small city, you know?
It's the best place to hide. It really is.
The oceans are... Yeah, you know, there's a really great guy named Dr. Kevin Newth out there. He's teaching.
Having delved into the intriguing accounts of credible witnesses, the conversation shifts to the unwavering factions that guard their secrets fiercely. Exploring the complexities of truth and disclosure in today's polarized landscape.
Really?
Yes, 100%. 100%. And this is why there is an absolutely, like, we are never going to give this up. Like, there are factions that will never give this up. They will never,
right.
Look, think of it, like.
But they will never give it up.
They'll never willingly give up this
secret. To protect us or to protect themselves?
Protect themselves, to protect the system that's in place.
Right, sure.
They may rationalize it to say, you people don't know what you're getting into, we're protecting you.
Right.
Like,
right.
I could see them justifying that.
Yeah.
Maybe they're right. We don't know all of it, do we? Mm-hmm. I believe in truth. I like to think that most of us believe in truth. And if I'm going to have faith in anything, it's going to be a faith in truth. Mm-hmm. What else? If you cannot believe in truth, what else you got? Like,
yeah.
So I'm going to believe in that. However, so let's say, now in 2010, when we wrote this, the country was not nearly as polarized as it is now. So in 2010, we're envisioning the president goes and tells the world, well, you know, this thing happened, this sighting occurred, we can't really ignore it anymore. Yes, it's real. And some of them are not human and they're here. That would be disclosure, right? That's kind of what we all imagine. And so even under that scenario, I think it's way more complex now, we can get to that. But even in that scenario, I was, you know, even in 2010, I was all over 9/11. I got into a lot of trouble among some UFO researchers because I was an early 9/11 conspiracy guy.
Were you?
Absolutely. I still am.
Really?
I'm not going to be insulted by that pack of lies.
We'll come back to that then.
Yeah. Yeah. there are people far more conversant with that than me. But yes, my dad worked at the World Trade Center back in September 01. He had the day off. My dad had the day off.
What?
My dad was a retired New York City cop at the time, and he had a really cool job as a fire safety director, as they were called, at the Twin Towers, yeah. He shared his job with a really nice man who I knew who was killed that day. His name was Billy. And really affected my dad. It was a real, real tough thing. So 9/11 was a very personal thing on that level. Mm. I mean, for anyone who went through that, of course, I'm not saying like more for me than anyone else, but my dad was there.
That's crazy. Was, so your dad knew a lot of people that died, and mm-hmm. I'm sure you did too.
Yeah, a lot of firefighters, of course, and a lot of good people.
One of my theories on 9/11 is that the people that were closest to it and affected by it the most emotionally and personally are the ones that have, and I could be wrong here, though, I think you proved this wrong, but those are the ones that have the least capacity to entertain any of the alternate ideas of happened, right? That don't go with the narrative, right? They seem to be the ones that go with the narrative. Yeah. The people who are more disconnected from it or even born after.
You're totally right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I almost wrote a book. Keep wondering about this on false flags, the history of false flag operations in our world. Mm-hmm. I got really into it. And in fact, I wrote a little TV series for Gaia Television a number of years ago on the history of false flags. You can go find it, go to Gaia and go look for it. That was much less than I had actually researched. I did a lot more research on false flags than I did for that series. But one thing that a false flag does to people, it's a real psychological head game that you play on people, because you're creating this massive trauma for your society. It's an emotional trauma. And what you're doing is this horrible, horrible thing happens, and people are naturally going to be deeply upset by it. And then what you do, this is the genius of it, you find the solution immediately, whether it's Hitler invading Poland and saying we were attacked by the Poles, which is what he did, or any other, there's a lot of false flags. America is the king of false flags, especially after World War II. And all the covert ops that we have done. But anyway, you create a catastrophe, a trauma that people freak out over, and you identify it, you connect the emotion to the intellect. So you have the emotional connection to some kind of, here's the explanation. And once you get that, people, like my own dad, my father, when I started really looking at 9/11, I used to talk to my dad on the phone about this. And I have to be careful because I could get emotional. So just forgive me here.
Sure, sure.
But my dad learns that, like, Richie, are you looking into it? I just saw this PBS thing and it just showed, he talked about the pancake theory that was put out, the total bullshit theory. But that was put out within a week of the event. This guy comes out and says, this is how it happened. Like, no, you have no freaking idea.
What was that theory, roughly?
The planes crashing caused a pancaking effect.
Oh, yeah.
Of the one floor and the other floor, gotcha. and all the way down. And it did not happen that way at all. But it was, so anyway, that goes on to PBS, which is total CIA op anyway. And my dad bought into it. Of course he did. You know, I don't blame him. And then he was like, he really had a struggle with the fact that his son was going all into this alternative theory about 9/11. And I talk with him every week on the phone. And he came around, you know, my dad, all right, we'll have to talk about something else. So let's move on. We'll come back to it when I can collect myself.
Sure. We were talking about disclosure and what it would look like and what the incentives would be for disclosure, and how you did mention that you think disclosure nowadays would be far more complex than it would have been in the past.
Yes, I do. Yeah, I do, because because Trump, if I can, am I allowed to say that on YouTube?
Yeah.
You know, he hits the scene in 2015, basically.
Actually, it will do better on YouTube if you say Trump.
Yeah, well. And, you know, I mean, how do you talk about this without 50% of the population shitting their pants? And the other, like, you know, so whatever I end up saying, someone's going to be upset. But basically, you have a guy who comes in that is the ultra most polarizing political figure that we've had since Abraham Lincoln. Mm-hmm. Lincoln was a highly polarizing president, if you really go back. Mm-hmm. But here comes Trump. And so now we're at a point where whether it's Trump or anyone else, whether if it was Biden, it wouldn't be no different, because a president who comes up there says anything on this.
With the complexities of political discourse laid bare, the conversation shifts to Stan's intriguing concept of the gray box, inviting a deeper exploration of how we process and validate extraordinary claims.
Stan had a great expression. He called something, he had a gray box, he said. If I don't know if it's true or false, I put it in my gray box.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of things that go in a gray box.
Sure.
And that, yeah, that's one of those things where, I mean, I would say let's keep it open and let's find out if there's any other research that can verify it to some extent. So yeah. you have Herrera, then you have Jake Barber, so that's 2 points. That's not equal to proof, but it makes it a little more interesting, and maybe we can move on from there. But that's the problem with a lot of the elements in this field. You're dealing with, I mean, by its very nature, the UFO, let me just keep saying UFO because I'm so used to it. We say UAP, whatever.
Yeah.
UFOs represent, I mean, we talk about it in our society often enough, but I am absolutely convinced we don't fully appreciate the depth of what it really means. I mean, look, imagine being across the table, not from me, but from one of them. And imagine they have an IQ of 500 and they're looking right at you and they've got a telepathic ability. Maybe they're connected to a hive mind. So they know everything that you don't know, and they can peer into your mind, into all the little avenues and recesses, and like, and they don't laugh at your jokes.
They're gonna run for the hills.
And they're, and even if they look like us, like, that's intimidating. That there's no way that's not going to be intimidating to run into beings like that, that operate on a completely different level, that we will not, we like to think that we'll be like that one day. I don't think so. No, we're not going to be like that. I'm not, and you're not. Maybe 1,000 years from now, who knows?
But, is there any story, is there any crazy story that's out there, right? The UFO, whether it be abduction or a sighting or anything that's like, there's no solid evidence one way or the other that you know for a fact is true.
Probably. I don't know. That's a great question. I wish I could have thought about this before. It's kind of tough. Kind of tough on the spot. So a story that has no,
whether it be like a. I mean, other than the fact that, you know, obviously we have like things like the Tic Tac, right? It's like a, we know that's, we've had people testify, and there's the footage, like the Go Fast and the FLIR stuff, but it's kind of like, it's grainy footage, whatever. And it's kind of like, take it for what it is. It could be DARPA, it could be non-human intelligence. But like, say there's one of these whistleblowers that come out, like Michael Herrera or Jake Barber or Bob Lazar, right? One of these sort of stories that you know for a fact.
Well, one, I mean, this isn't a UFO incident, but this was the Davis-Wilson notes that I talked about a little earlier when we talked about Eric Davis. I knew for a fact when those things came out in 2019, that document, I knew it was real. And there were a lot of people at the time who were saying it's fake. One person said it was a movie script. One person, and a lot of people were just saying it's complete disinformation.
Yeah.
And I, for a while there, I the only person publicly to take a stand on it.
Wow.
Yeah, and everyone's like throwing all kinds of shit at me, and that's fine. But I'm like, and there were a couple of people who privately had said to me, I know it's real too. I was shown this in whatever year, but I can't go out. I can't say it publicly. So I understood, that's fine. But I, during that whole period, there were some really snarky, nasty people that popped up out of nowhere and then have since disappeared. It's like, who are you? Who are these people?
Well, interesting.
Yeah. But anyway, I always knew that would be vindicated. I just didn't know when. But now, then you get, you know, Jacques Vallée talked about it in his Forbidden Science, one of his volumes, his diaries.
Oh, really?
Yes. He mentioned knowledge of it at the time.
When the astronaut died.
Before that. Yeah, I think in his volume that covers 2000 to 2009, when Davis actually interviewed Wilson during that period, Vallée knew about this. And it's in there. Also, Eric Davis himself, short of saying, I wrote them, several times, interviews that he did in 2019, 2020, and then just at the briefing, Elizondo, this is one good thing Elizondo did, he mentioned that he introduced Davis by way of those notes. Oh, wow. And so he obviously knows it's real. Like that whole crowd, they all know it's all real. But there's been enough confirmation. And Davis himself, if you really listen to him, even in the briefing, it's quite obvious he makes it clear without saying. He's got to be careful. These people, those notes themselves are not classified, but they talk about something that is highly classified. Wow. You know, they were private notes, so it's not like an official government document, but it is discussing something that is extremely sensitive.
Let's take this opportunity. I got to take a quick bathroom break. We'll jump right back in. We're back, folks. We're back. We were talking about, what were we talking about? Steve, do you remember what we're talking about? We want to talk more about the military aspect of this USO stuff.
Yeah.
Before we do that, mm-hmm. one of my questions that I've been wanting to ask you is, I'm sure you do know about this base. I talked about it with Jesse when he was on here, that there was a decommissioned, I think it was a Navy base in the Bahamas that was specifically in charge of tracking some of this stuff, this underwater UFO stuff. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Specifically, well, there was there's a system that was known as SOSUS when it was developed, the sound undersea sonar system. Mm-hmm. And it was originally set up in that area, like near the Bahamas. So I don't know if that's what he's referring to.
No, this was a base. Steve, if you pull up the podcast I did with Jesse, it's in the timestamps. I think it's its own dedicated timestamp.
I should know it. Just talking about it. I
think NASA was involved with it too.
I could put into my second or third volume.
Is that what you were talking about? The Atlantic?
Oh, AUTEC. Yeah.
Okay. AUTEC. That's what it was.
Okay.
So, apparently the way I understand it is they had some sort of, maybe it was like a, whoa, holy macaroni, bless you. Underwater sort of base to track and detect things, something like this.
Yeah, so I am aware of that, and I do have a little, I've learned a few things. Jesse may know more than I do. I don't know, I'll have to hear what he has to say.
Yeah.
One of the things that I try to do with this study is two things. One is track the cases. And then the other is to try to understand the technological, military, political, and other related developments that went on at the same time. So what I try to, I structure this book, these books, I break them into chapters. And at the beginning of each chapter, I try to highlight like what's developing here, what's our technology, what's our politics, what's relevant. Mm-hmm. And so the development of a lot of the Navy systems has gone into that section of each book, the chapters. And so I remember I wrote about SOSUS, and I have information on AUTEC.
That's it for today's summary. To stay up to date with more summaries and news, follow us on X and Instagram and visit our website, podsummarizer.xyz. If you have any comments, questions, suggestions, or complaints about the content displayed, please do not hesitate to write to us at info@podsummarizer.xyz. Thank you for listening.